Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Between now and the November election, we're going to begin every single show with the words of Colonel Vindman in his testimony, assuring his father he will be all right. Of course, we know he is not all right. He was perp-walked out of the White House, and now the president, or our traitor-in-chief, is now going after Vindman to try to see if he can jail him. So, again, remember Vindman. You will hear the words of Colonel Vindman in his testimony before Congress. And then after that, we'll join Scott Braddock, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps, the editor of the Quorum Report.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Hi, Scott. How are you? This is the Friday edition of The Attitude. Scott Braddock, lucky us, was in New Hampshire to cover the New Hampshire primary, everyone. How exciting is this? I have to start first by saying this is the second New Hampshire primary you've been joining me with, Scott. So tell me about your thoughts from last time's primary and this time's primary. I would love a Texas impression of the primary since you've had an opportunity to sort of dip your teabag in twice.
I was trying to think about what had happened 4 years ago. Senator Cruz, of course, was on the campaign trail there in New Hampshire. He had just had a strong showing in Iowa, and sort of, in some ways sort of surprised people in Iowa, which Iowa has surprises, right? Y'all don't seem to have as many surprises, at least lately, Arnie. We kind of knew what was going to happen going in. Am I wrong about that?
Yes, I'm totally right.
Over the last decade, maybe?
Yep.
Well, especially with Bernie in there. You know, Bernie's from right next door. As you know all too well, and your listeners know all too well, the states that are in New England are so affected by each other's politics. I was really fascinated by that. You know, you've got those folks moving up from Massachusetts or Taxachusetts, as those people like to say, creating more of a conservative element in the southern part of the state. You're right there next to Vermont, as you described, you know, this sort of long state that goes on up to Canada. And you are impacted by the media bias that you see in Vermont and in Massachusetts. In Texas, we're sort of isolated, Arnie. Like, if something happens in Louisiana or New Mexico, that would never impact how we vote here. You know, we're a big state, and our major media markets are further away from those places. It's just not the case. But Cruz was coming on strong, of course, you know, last time, 4 years ago. And really battled it out with Trump,
right?
All the way to the point of the Republican National Convention,
right?
When Cruz refused to endorse Trump,
and now he's
a
total lackey.
We may be on track for that on the Democratic side. Things are sort of muddled after Iowa and New Hampshire. Is it fair to say, Arnie? Because you've been watching New Hampshire way longer than I have. Fair to say, though, that even though Bernie did win, you know, he won by less. Of course, there's more candidates in the race, but I don't think that you can fairly just say Bernie's the front runner, as some people are trying to say. My Twitter feed is filled with people saying that.
Let me just say something. So, actually, we're going to have a guy on from the New Republic right on after you,
yep.
Alex Shepard, and it's really interesting. So, the New York Times made some statement today that said that Bernie only got 26-27% of the vote, and that the rest of the moderates or non-progressives got 70%. And what Alex did was so interesting. He said, "Really?" He said, "So let's look at the five major candidates: Biden, Buttigieg, and Amy Klobuchar. They got 35% of the vote."
Yep.
And guess what? Warren and Bernie got 52% of the vote. And what I did, just to let you know, Scott, I went I went into the voting booth, and what happened when I went into the voting booth was that I had the pencil in my hand for 5 minutes. For 5 minutes. I did not know what
trembling?
I was doing.
Were you and trembling over the paper?
I was trembling.
Trying to figure out what to do?
Exactly. And let
I
me
want
tell
this to be very dramatic.
It was as dramatic as you're describing, believe it or not, because I was almost crying. And I was trying to figure out between whether I should do Bernie, because I'm so angry at the national media, or Warren. I picked Warren. Listen
Why?
To what my choices were, because I actually believe in her policies, because I actually believe she would be a great president. I don't
You're
think she's
crazy.
No, I don't think she has political skills, which is really what bothers me.
Yes, but I
actually think that she would be a better president, but I also believe in the policies of Bernie. So there you go. Arnie had a choice between whom? Between Warren and Bernie. That's 52% of the electorate right there. And I'm going to add something else. No. In New Hampshire. I'm going to also say to you, if you look at Yang and you look at Stiers, the other two that are not Klobuchar and Biden and whatever, Yang is not a moderate, and either was Stiers. Stiers ran on the health care for all. He ran on all those policies.
He's certainly trying to sound progressive.
Exactly. Well, he's been sounding progressive for a long time. Mm-hmm. So what I'm just telling you is that this, but it's too soon. It's too soon.
Yes,
and
right.
And let me also say something else, and this is where I am totally apoplectic. When I hear them talking about comparing on MSNBC, and we're going to be talking about this in the second half of the show too, but you're going to hear me wax poetic twice. When they talk about the fact that, you know, they did not react to the rise of Donald Trump in time, and on MSNBC this morning, they were warning everyone to react to the rise of Bernie Sanders, comparing the rise of Sanders to the rise of Trump. I want to remind everyone, the national media really created Donald Trump. They gave him $2 billion in free media. They have been trashing Bernie for 4 years. So understand, not only have they been trying to destroy him, not only do they not mention him or only mention him in a negative way, but they have to own the fact that they own Trump. And to compare Trump to Bernie is just, it's immoral. It's immoral. That guy is a traitor. That guy is a tyrant. Ask people about Bernie. Bernie will never do that. I've known him for 40 years. I am sorry. This is disgusting. Sorry,
well, you know, whatever people think about their track records and their policies, you're exactly right. Was created by media. You know, remember, Morning Joe would have on MSNBC, they would have Trump on almost every day while he was seeking the Republican nomination. And I remember, you know, the folks sort of grumbling out of the Ted Cruz camp, but what is it about Trump that they just give him a pass on everything and let him say anything he wants? And, of course, Arnie, it's that he's such good TV. He's a TV performer. The ratings are going through the roof. It's a ratings bonanza. The national media loves this. And Cruz is just not as good TV. Sorry, we couldn't provide that for you out of Texas.
Yeah.
You would have had, you know, something resembling sort of a normal Republican presidency.
Yes.
I would say that. And I'm not the biggest Ted Cruz fan, as you know. The junior senator from Texas, I think, represents Ted Cruz more than he represents Texas. It was just a remarkable thing. I don't see that happen. I mean, now I see something else happening with Bernie, that he does have, you know, legitimate grassroots support. I do think that it's interesting and that you chose Warren. I wonder if one of the reasons you went with Warren is not just because you agree with her policies and you think she would be a good president and a better president than Bernie. I can tell you there's a lot of progressives I talk to here in Texas. We do have quite a few of them, Arnie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just way more conservatives, at least so far. But the progressives here are very turned off by not Bernie, but by Bernie's supporters. You saw this at some of the rallies in Iowa and New Hampshire, where any time one of the other candidates is mentioned, at one of these rallies, it's all the booing and, you know, screw mm-hmm. that guy or that woman or whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
All the Bernie bros who have to attack everybody over everything. It comes across as very... I know that the ideas are different, but it comes across as very Tea Party-esque to a lot of people.
With
the Democratic Party, folks are saying, I don't like the way these people behave. And it's turning a lot of people off. But one person said, it's really a weird feeling, as a Democrat, so it's really a weird feeling to like Bernie but just hate his supporters.
Well, so this is...
Is there anything to that?
No, well, I don't know. I mean, there are nasty people
sometimes. I'm sure this will do... by the way, I'm sure me saying this on the radio will do wonders for my Twitter mentions.
What I am going to tell you is that there is a level of harshness now in all the political campaigns that
I don't see Klobuchar supporters doing that or Bloomberg supporters doing that.
Let me just say something. The part of the problem... problem
calm your ass down.
No. Let me just say something. Let me stop. The problem is that when you see the system so rigged in such an incredible way, there's a level of animosity that continues to build and build and build. And then when you see the national media again rigging the coverage, it builds and builds and builds. They are creating an acrid, angry base for Bernie supporters. In the beginning, that's not how it was. Yep. Trust me, it was not how it was. But guess what? It's almost like they're wearing people out and they're growing scales and they're growing fingernails and they're just so angry. If the media had been fair, you wouldn't see the harshness. And I am going to remind everyone that they're...
I get it,
that,
but can I give one quick life lesson to people? Yes. You are responsible for your behavior.
I totally agree. And let me, so can I just share one more thing? The reason I ended up going with Elizabeth Warren was that I had two events that happened the morning of the election that made me love her. It was like this woman that was knocking on doors and trudging through the snow. I didn't even know her. I was there.
I was having a cigar on your front porch. This woman walks up.
And she was saying to me, I don't know who you're supporting, but thank you for what you do. And then she told me this story.
Nice.
And it was like I looked at her and I loved her. And in a funny way, I didn't want to let her down. Isn't that bizarre that I am so emotional?
No, it's not bizarre at all. It's a real human connection.
By the way,
can I say one thing
and
about
you did see
States,
that. You
Arnie?
Did see it. Actually, that's right. You're my witness. You're my witness.
I was there. I was enjoying Le Promesse by my father's cigars. It was fantastic. So I'm sitting there watching you have this interaction.
Right.
And I'm thinking about, you know, as a Texan, we talked about this a little bit when I was in studio with you earlier in the week. With Texas, it's such a giant political landscape.
Right.
People don't understand how big Texas is, really,
right.
Especially those of you from New England or from New York or D.C. or whatever. Just don't get it. I often tell this story, but when I used to work at CBS News in Dallas, CBS News desk there at KRLD Radio, some tragedy had happened in El Paso, and I can't make this up. There was a situation that had unfolded far west Texas, and the New York desk calls us in Dallas and says, are you sending a reporter to El Paso? And my answer instantly was, call the station in Los Angeles because they're physically closer.
Oh, my God.
Right? People don't understand just how big it is. And Democratic strategists for years have told me that everybody who talks about turning Texas blue, they don't get how big it is. You know, there was a guy running for governor years ago, 2006, and his strategists had told me that they did this, you know, barnstorming deal where they went around and talked to editorial boards, TV, radio, everything. They did it for 3 weeks. And when they were done with it, the guy's name idea had gone up 1 point. It's just such a giant place. So things have to be moved through mass media. And I know we're going to talk about Bloomberg here, and that's part of his strategy, of course, a huge part of it. But in those small states, Arnie, you know, there's all this talk now, should Iowa go first? Should New Hampshire be the first state and all that? And I get the criticisms, you know, it's all white people and blah, blah, and all that. But there is something good about the fact that the kind of interactions you're talking about are the kind of interactions that change minds. Real conversations, talking to folks about issues. Candidates have to sort of humble themselves, right, and go talk to people where they actually live. And so, you know, this idea of doing away with the early states, it's... people need to go see it for themselves before they make a call on
it. And it really is intimate. You really do get to know people.
I appreciate it.
And there is value because before they end up on the national stage, what you have to remember is that we get to sort of evaluate them as human beings. We get to see them as real. And there's a piece of that that disappears once they leave here because then it becomes flyover territory. Then it becomes something more, you know, bigger and untouchable. And in the end, you want to be able to know, do they work with the touch or do they also work on the national stage? There are two components to every president. That's one of the components. So by the way, everyone, I'm going to just urge you. We had Scott Braddock, John Nichols and Robert Hennelly from New York on the air the other day. And I'm just going to boast to you, Scott Braddock, because I want to reinforce this. I have sent the conversation from Wednesday's show to virtually everyone I know of the three of you talking about Bloomberg. And I thought it was the most amazing conversation.
Really coordinated something good there.
I sent it to the American Prospect. I sent it to the Huffington Post. I sent it to the New Republic. I have sent it around. I'm just going to urge people, as you listen to the show now on your station, it will be the best of the attitude, I promise you. But if nothing else, go and grab a podcast of that second half of the show. It was Wednesday's show. It was the day after the New Hampshire primary. If you want to understand Bloomberg in the most amazing way, those three men gave the best analysis and description of his past and his now political present. It was phenomenal. So thank you so much, Scott. We're going to have Glenn Smith on mm-hmm. Thursday from Texas as well. So I know we're going to be talking a little bit about Texas turning blue and about Bloomberg, but I want your take as well. You are going to be, we air this show on Friday, but we tape it Thursday morning. You are actually going to be driving down to Houston, Texas, because Bloomberg is going to be addressing Houston in Texas with the mayor of Houston. And of course, what we do know is the mayor of Houston just endorsed Michael mm-hmm. Bloomberg. Will you describe the mayor of Houston to my audience? Because I think it's important for them to know who he is, the size of Houston, what he means, and why you may not be surprised that he endorsed Mayor Bloomberg.
Sylvester Turner, the mayor of Houston, has been one of the forces, if you will, in Texas politics for decades. He first ran for mayor more than two decades ago. In the meantime, he has been in the Texas House of Representatives. He was elected to the mayor's office. This is his second term now. And he's been an effective mayor, although he has had some fights with organized labor that preceded the decision to not have the DNC in Houston this year, which you might remember. Interesting, Turner is somebody who has always understood where the levers of power are, how to get to them, even though he's been serving in the minority party in the Texas legislature for most of his career. When he started as a state legislator, Turner was serving under a Democratic Speaker of the House. That was going back to the Pete Laney days. That's before Tom Craddock, before Joe Strauss, before Dennis Bonin. And at the time, Turner was an effective legislator. And interesting, Arnie, you know about Joe Strauss, the former
speaker. Yeah, of course. You taught me well. You've taught me well. We so miss Joe Strauss.
Yes. They sort of really wishing we were back in the Strauss era right now in Texas, the Republicans are, even though so many of them attacked him for years as being, quote, too liberal. But here you had Strauss, who was the successor to what I would say was a more conservative speaker, a guy named Tom Craddock, who was from Midland. And under both of those Republican speakers, Turner was able to be a powerful member of the legislature, even though he's African-American and is from the minority party. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is in a legislative body that is being run by, you know, Republican white guys, right?
Right.
But he knows how to navigate, is my point.
That's
giving him a lot of credit here.
There's value in that, everyone. There's tremendous value.
Well, you know, you can see that Turner is also, and, you know, I think on the show, Mr. Nichols, when we were discussing all this, talked about the idea that Bloomberg has been cultivating these mayors around the
for
nation,
decades,
you know,
for decades, years, for
be,
years,
to be
yes.
his allies, to mm-hmm. be on his side. So no huge shock that the mayor of the fourth largest city in the United States, the most diverse city in the United States, now says, quote, "We need a president who knows how cities run. It's why I'm proud to endorse Mike for president, and I look forward to sending him to Washington in November." Tonight, the Harris County Democratic Party, which Harris County includes Houston, at least most of Houston. Houston, by the way, has grown out of its home county, by the way. It extends into Fort Bend now. It's just such a large thing, not like when I was a kid. Anyway, the Harris County Democratic Party tonight has their big fundraising dinner.
Tonight being Thursday night, everyone. Just so I want to remind everyone, you're hearing this on Thursday night. Okay.
So he'll be there. Bloomberg, it was announced just last week, was coming into Texas to be there for the Harris County Democratic fundraiser. I'm old enough to remember when they had to beg people to come to the Harris County Democratic Party fundraisers, Arnie.
And is now it sold out? You know,
presidential,
is it sold out?
Of course, and the presidential candidates now want to be there. Bloomberg there. This is, I believe, his third trip to Houston mm-hmm. in 6 weeks. And he's been making multiple trips to Texas. Bloomberg has been traveling what we have called and Jeremy Wallace at the Houston Chronicle, a colleague of mine. We do a Texas Take podcast every week if people want to check it out. Jeremy Wallace has called the I-35 corridor the blue spine of Texas, mm-hmm. from 35 down from the Laredo area all and then the valley all the way up to Dallas-Fort Worth. The 22 counties along that area have seen explosive growth, and it's trending toward the Democrats. Same thing as Houston, which is further to the east, sort of creates this triangle of Democratic dominance in a state that is still run by Republicans.
So I just want to make a suggestion. Check out how many seats Bloomberg bought. Okay. No. I'm dead.
I'll do that. Maybe I'll take
yes.
one of them.
Well, I'm just telling
I'm sure
you.
Sure, they need to fill those. Well, I don't know if everybody.
No, I don't mean that. Who is he gifting those seats to? Before I let you go, though, I do have to ask about the Supreme Court case that Texas is objecting to California's refusing to let people who are funded by the state to go to conferences and events in Texas. What the hell is this about? It sounds so trite and vindictive.
Of course, it's trite. These things. California and Texas, this goes back to the Rick Perry days. Californians need to move. By the way, it's that Californians need to move to Texas, but we don't want California business and back and forth. Perry would always brag about the fact that if you rented a U-Haul and you were renting one to go from Texas to California, it cost less than if you were going the other way around.
Right.
Still true.
Right.
I haven't gotten down into the weeds of that legal case, but I can tell you that it's more of this nonsense. One of the things that is true that I have seen over the course of my career in covering politics here for about 20 years is that you can only have it be a public policy priority to try to lure businesses and people from California to Texas before that will impact the politics of the state. 1,100 people move to Texas every day. Where do you think they're moving to?
That's
they're moving
incredible.
To the suburbs, particularly the suburbs around Houston, Dallas-Fort Worth, Austin, San Antonio, et cetera, and what has happened to the political makeup of those areas, Arnie? Those are the new melting pots. The suburbs are the melting pots, and this is where Republicans are going to sweat their elections this November. You had in 2018 Republicans around the state, particularly in the Texas House, either lose to Democrats or come very close to losing against no-name, no-money, no-funding Democrats all over the place. Whether that will be true again this year, we'll all stay tuned, but there were three things that basically conspired to make that happen in 18, right? It was you had the Beto effect, people going wild about Beto. You had the backlash to President Trump, and you had Ted Cruz on the ballot, who is not even well-liked by a lot of Republicans. Keep in mind, about 500,000 people voted both for Beto O'Rourke and Greg Abbott. I don't think that those are extreme liberal Democrats.
So let me
disillusioned, but I would say this. Two of those things won't be true this time around, no Beto, no Cruz. But you do have Trump, and the backlash to Trump by vote totals is higher than it was to President Obama in 2010.
All right, so let me just say something else. So you have been talking a lot about the fact that the Democratic Party, although Beto was so nearly successful in taking on Ted Cruz, that the Democratic Party basically really doesn't have kind of the financial muscle, doesn't have the organization, that it really, because it was so devastated by the Republican takeover. One of the sort of frightening things about Mayor Bloomberg is that not only will Bloomberg be running for president, not only be dumping millions, if not billions, into his campaign, he is also going to then start dumping millions into the Democratic structure in Texas.
Sure.
So where Texas didn't have a strong Democratic Party, he will say, not a problem. Let me help you. We'll help you with operatives. We'll help you with get out the vote people. We'll help you with this. And all of a sudden, the Republicans in Texas have to be afraid because Bloomberg will match the National Republican Party dollar for dollar. They'll match the governor dollar for dollar in what they're able to do and put into the Democratic sort of skeleton in Texas and put some flesh on that meat. And that's what he's doing. And the other thing I'm just going to remind everyone is if you listen to me almost a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, I unfortunately, or maybe not knowing it, I said it was time for a mayor to be president. And the reason I said I thought it was time for a mayor to be president is that mayors know where the buck stops. They know why things have to happen. In Washington, nobody has responsibility for anything. They don't know about a pothole. They don't know about an electric line down. They don't really understand a flood in the way the mayor of Houston does, the mayor of Detroit does, the mayor of New York does. And that's what I was saying. What it never occurred to me is that the 8th richest person in the United States would basically bring his checkbook to the table and say, no problem, I'll buy this.
Oh, isn't our naivete so cute?
It is cute.
He comes in and he's going to replace infrastructure for Democrats. The DNC sort of a mess, and the Texas Democratic Party, they would tell you that whether they get help early, in the middle, or late in an election, they will take it. By the way, the chairman of the Republican Party of Texas, James Dickey, has said that in this state, the total political spend across races from the presidency on the way all the way down, is going to be $1 billion, and that's why the Republican Party of Texas is gearing up to try to register new voters.
Right.
They're raising millions of dollars to try to do that and fight back against an ascendant Democratic Party.
Scott Braddock, we love you. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report. He's known as the voice of Texas. He joined us in studio this week. How lucky were we? We now have on the air, of course, if it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. We will talk to you soon, and someday I'm coming to Austin. I'm just telling you right now.
It's going to happen, Arnie.
I know it's going to happen. All right, everyone, stick around. We're going to do Alex Shepard from the New Republic. His lead piece, Bernie Sanders has an MSNBC problem. Stick around. We'll be right back.
When going with the flow makes economic sense. On this current cast. Thousands of dams across the U.S. harness rivers to reap a variety of goods and services. But as those dams age, their owners can face significant repair or maintenance costs. Brian Graber of the nonprofit American Rivers says when this happens, many owners find it makes economic sense to remove the dam instead of fixing it.
And there is funding available for dam removal that is not available for dam repair.
That's because removing a dam creates another kind of public resource. By restoring a river's flow, it can revitalize community riverfronts and boost local fishing and boating industries. And in some cases, that makes removal a better fix than repair. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more at currentcast.org.
Trails of troubles, rows of battles, paths of victory we shall walk. The road is dusty, the road is a mighty rough, better road is awaiting, the day is not far off. Trails of trouble, rows of battles, paths of victory we shall walk. I walk down by the river, I turn my head up high, I saw that silver lining that was hanging in the sky. Well, I saw trails of trouble, the rows of battles, paths of victory we shall walk. The gravel road is a bumpy, well, it's a harder road to ride. There's a clearer road awaiting, with the cinders on the other side. Oh, we got trails of our trouble, and we got rows of our battle, paths of our victory we shall walk. Evening train was a rolling, a humming of the wheels. I saw a better day as I looked across the field. Well, I saw trails of our troubles, rows of our battles, paths of our victory we shall walk. The trail is dusty, the road is a mighty rough, the good road awaiting, oh, the day is not far off. Oh, we got trails, trails of our trouble, and we got our roads, roads of our battles, paths of victory we shall walk.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott. So Alex Shepard has been writing some phenomenal pieces at The New Republic. There are two pieces in front of me right now that we're going to be talking about. The first one is the one that you've kind of heard me talk about almost, you know, without his headline. Bernie Sanders has an MSNBC problem. Cable news network, particularly the liberal one, a growing barrier to his surging campaign. And then last but not least, we'll also put his most recent piece at The New Republic, How to Do the Math Like a Pundit. Bernie Sanders' rise has led the media to look everywhere except the ballot box for the real winner of elections in Iowa and New Hampshire. So let me welcome Alex to the program. Thank you so much for joining me, Alex.
It's good to be back.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about Bernie Sanders and his MSNBC problem. I've stopped throwing things at the TV, screaming at the TV, but it isn't just MSNBC. It's the entire media that has either not given him any kind of time or acknowledgement that he even exists as a candidate, or if they do, it is to literally trash him. So any comparisons between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump is beyond a fiction.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's this tendency to always view everything through the lens of the last election, but also through the lens of what is and is not deemed possible by elite pundits. And in this case, they're basically trying to work backwards from an equation, and they're saying the solution to the equation is that Bernie Sanders can't win, and therefore everything that we're seeing in front of us must be wrong or improbable.
Right.
And it's causing some, I think, rather strange discourse on MSNBC in particular.
So let's talk a little bit about, let's do the analysis. Let's do some breakdowns of his coverage. I think it's important for people to know we're not just saying this. We're not imagining it. It is incredibly real.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you're seeing, which I think is kind of shocking, is that MSNBC, a lot of people, Chris Matthews, Chuck Todd in particular, Stephanie Ruhle as well, are basically adopting Republican talking points about Sanders. They're making the case that, you know, even though he is notably a Democratic socialist, you know, you've got Chris Matthews talking about Fidel Castro and executions in Central Park.
Oh,
you've got
God.
Chuck Todd reading from right-wing websites that are calling Sanders supporters brown shirts, despite the fact that he is Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this, like, general sense of unease and panic about Sanders representing this sort of extremism, when in fact, if you were to look at things globally, you know, he's a standard issue social Democrat.
So what is so interesting, and this is really important, I think you should go, he's always comparing himself to Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Finland. That's always what he's talking about. And he uses the policies there to talk about the kind of policies he's talking about. So what I've been doing is, I went to St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, yeah, sure, you betcha, one of the biggest Norwegian Lutheran schools in the country. And a lot of Norwegians go to that school. So what I've done is I've talked to my Norwegian, Swedish, and Danish, and Finnish friends, and I said, so what kind of democratic socialist are you? And they look at me, and they roll their eyes, and they go, actually, Arnie, we're compassionate capitalists. All right? They don't even – that's an old word from 40 years ago. My problem with Bernie Sanders is he's kind of in a language rut. He's in the old rut of 40 years ago, and that's how he's defined himself, and he's never chosen to change it, even though if you go to those countries, they kind of have. And the other thing I wanted to remind people is that, you know what, you're always worried about in those countries, could you ever be wildly rich? Do you know that in Sweden, it's more likely that you'll be a billionaire in Sweden than being a billionaire in the United States? There are more billionaires per capita in Sweden than in the United States. So again, part of the problem is, does MSNBC want to know this? No. To compare him to Fidel Castro? Oh my God. And it's not just the language they use, but don't you see something else on MSNBC? A lot of the never-Trumper Republicans are so distraught because they can't appear on Fox. They're now beginning to own MSNBC. And what they want the Democratic Party to become is the moderate Republican Party that has been eaten up and thrown out by Donald Trump.
I think there's two important things there. One is about MSNBC, which, you know, despite the fact that most of the discourse about the Democratic Party itself has been about this, I think, somewhat overstated divide between the party's sort of left wing and its moderate wing, MSNBC has made a conscious decision during the Trump administration to sort of further embed itself with sort of cast-offs from the national security state, and
right.
It sort of has emphasized the kind of Russia investigation stuff over any of Trump's other domestic policies, and that's resulted in a sort of skewed pundit base.
Thank you.
The other thing is that these never-Trump people, they don't represent a constituency anywhere within either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. They're
mm-hmm.
not, you know, their share of the vote is minuscule. It's not
right.
anything, but they're able to sort of capture this sense of authenticity because they say, oh, if Democrats were to adopt my political viewpoints, which, again, almost no one in the country shares, then that's the only way that they can win back The White House. It's just not true.
Right. And the other thing is, and I said this on the ABC set the other day, and I actually said it on CNN. And what I said was that what you have to understand is what Bernie Sanders did in 2016, he set the agenda for 2020. Virtually all the candidates are now more to the left than any candidate that ran, whether it was Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, because they really sort of changed the spectrum of the conversation. Even Mayor Pete, when he says Medicare for all who want it, guess what the words are at the beginning? Medicare for all. Nobody was allowed to say those words in 2015, in 2016, until Bernie Sanders started talking about it. Look what Bernie Sanders did when he talked about the minimum wage. Who did he make raise wages? Jeff Bezos, because he attacked Amazon and Jeff Bezos, the richest man on the planet, for how he paid horrific wages to his people in Amazon. So in an ironic way, the Democratic Party has really embraced so much of Bernie Sanders, and now you've got Trump calling him a communist, and you got people on MSNBC embracing that same language.
Yeah, and I think that there's another question, which I think is still unresolved, which is to what extent people's concern about Sanders's and Warren's electability is innate, which is to say, how much of it is coming from voters, and how much of it is coming from people in the media who are panicking about, I think, both of these candidates. Warren has tailed off a little bit. And are sort of saying that these things are unelectable. You know, you've got Chuck Todd every other week on Meet the Press going on these sort of arias about how, you know, well, Sanders, you know, he's a socialist, and I grew up in Miami, and you know what people in Florida think about socialism.
It's amazing.
You know, I think that that has set the table as much as the sort of, you know, in some ways rather antiquated concern about socialism versus capitalism.
Right, and part of the reason why young people are supporting him is that they're seeing that crony capitalism has failed them. That's the problem. They're looking at debt, they're looking at climate change and the climate crisis, they're looking at the growing gap between rich and poor. You know what I describe student debt as? The anti-dowry. And the reason it's the anti-dowry is now they're stuck in their parents' basement. This is not what they envisioned, and they're looking at what capitalism wrought, and they're saying, so tell me why this is virtue. And they're saying it's not virtue. It is limiting my future. And that is what people, I don't think, quite comprehend. So it is very interesting to me to see the MSNBC problem. And at least Donald Trump has a reliable Fox. What does real progressives, or frankly, an alternative to Donald Trump, really have? You now have an MSNBC that, let's be honest here, Alex, they are setting it up for Michael Bloomberg. They want Michael Bloomberg to win, not Mayor Pete, not Amy Klobuchar, not any of those things. They would love it because what Michael Bloomberg will do is what Donald Trump did. Donald Trump gave them ratings, and that's why he got $2 billion in free media. What Bloomberg does is he writes checks.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a bias. There's always a bias, particularly in mainstream media, but anywhere, towards a story. I mean, I think that it's a little strange because Sanders' rise is itself a story. It's a pretty good one.
It's a very good one.
And it's one that I think has been covered mostly at a distance because I think, as you said, there's a real refusal to reckon with the state of play economically for people who are not 65 and older,
exactly.
White people, who, again, those are MSNBC voters. They're also Fox voters. But that refusal, I think, just says so much about the interests of the media itself, where, you know, we're hearing so much about how good the economy is. Well, that's not true for most people who are under 40, and that is Bernie Sanders' base.
So, and let me just, before we go to your next article, How to Do the Math Like a Pundit, again, we're talking with Alex Shepard. He writes at the New Republic. These articles are fabulous. So let me just say something else, and I've been talking about this a lot. So one of the things that Donald Trump is crowing about, and frankly, they even might even say about the good economy on MSNBC, is how now finally maybe the bottom 20% is seeing that their wages are ultimately rising, and they're blaming this good economy. What they should actually blame is the increase in the minimum wage across the country. New York increased the minimum wage. California increased the minimum wage. Seattle increased the minimum wage. Cities and states across the country since 2015 have been raising the minimum wage. Who do you think earns the minimum wage? It isn't because of the economy. It's because finally they're going from $7.25 an hour to $9 an hour, from $9 an hour to $10 an hour. And isn't it ironic? It's government that's making sure that the bottom can survive.
Yeah, and I think that that's 100% correct, and that it was sort of fight for 15. And
right, exactly.
And there's the other people that are responsible for what little increase in wage parity we've seen over the last few years. But also, if you look at the total share of who's actually gotten the gains of this economic boom, which again was has been sort of set off, one, by low interest rates, but also by a pretty foolish corporate tax cut, we're still getting a pittance of right. the larger gains. I mean, it's a tiny, tiny amount, and the idea that this sort of booming economy, this tight labor market, is somehow one was an actual outgrowth of what Trump was doing. It's not.
And one more thing, and then we have to go to your second article, and that is look at the rise in debt. Look at the rise in debt, and look at the rise in the number of people defaulting on their debt. And it's, if we don't talk about increasing the minimum wage, rise in debt, defaulting on debt, why people are doing this, this is not a good economy for 80% of the American people. I'm sorry. They may play in the market, but when you have two shares, you're not in the market. When you basically own a third of, you know, some major stock company, you do play in the market. And that's where your two shares may have gone up by 50 cents. Hallelujah. All right, let's go to how to do the math like a pundit. Bernie Sanders' rise has led the media to look everywhere except the ballot box for the real winner of elections in Iowa and New Hampshire. Why don't you share with my audience the spin that's coming out of the New York Times, the spin that's happening on MSNBC as how they're reading the results both in Iowa and in New Hampshire?
Yeah, I mean, there's this sort of very strange thing that's been happening where instead of looking at the race candidate by candidate, there's this drive to turn the candidates into super candidates. There's a progressive candidate, which is Sanders and Warren together, and a moderate candidate who is either Biden, Buttigieg, and Klobuchar, or the field. Mm-hmm. And then they say, well, it may look like Sanders has won and that he has all the momentum and that he's the only candidate who's polling in the top two in all four of the first states. But instead they say, well, you know, if you look at it in the big picture sense, he's only at about 35%, whereas the field is 52%. That's not how voters work. It's not how elections work.
Right.
And it ends up being pretty silly. I mean, it's a similar thing is also happening where in New Hampshire they say, well, Bernie Sanders won again, but actually, the real winner is Amy Klobuchar because she came in third.
So let me just read from your piece. Michael Barbaro, the host of New York Times podcast The Daily, made a similar case about the fact that Bernie really didn't win. And he writes this. One way of thinking about what happened is that Bernie Sanders got around a quarter of the vote and he won, Barbaro said. But another way of thinking about it is if you add up all the moderates together, they collectively got something like 70% of the vote. And then you did the interesting math. Parentheses. If the contest were between Sanders and Warren and Buttigieg, Klobuchar and Biden, the result would be something like 52 for Sanders and Warren and 35 for Buttigieg, Klobuchar and Biden. So again, you know, it's so they do the math that's convenient for their narrative. That's exactly what they're doing. You absolutely pointed out. But I think what is really frightening here is that the other thing is that when you look at the poorer towns in my state, Bernie won them. If you look at the college towns in my state, Bernie won them. And what did the other group win? They won in larger turnouts in the more well-heeled states. Where do you think new voters are? Do you think new voters are in the well-heeled cities? No, new voters are in the poor towns and the college towns. And if we want to expand the base, why would you want to alienate them?
Yeah, I think there's this. I think there's this other issue, which is this assumption that voters are monolithic blocks, that you
yes.
belong to either the progressive team or the moderate team, and you know, Warren voters will automatically transfer to Sanders, and that Biden voters will automatically transfer to Mayor Pete or Amy Klobuchar. If you look into the actual like polling data, if you talk to voters for that matter, you get a sense that they're much more complicated than that.
Right.
They, you know, recently, right, Pete's rise has come not at the expense of Joe Biden, but at Elizabeth Warren's expense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Bernie Sanders is the second choice for more Biden voters than any other candidate. You know, that's difficult, especially if you're a narrative journalist, but it's also
true.
What's true.
Yeah, no, and so I've said this a number of times. I'm going to repeat it over and over again. One of the most thoughtful progressives, incredibly stable, serious, does policy. He's a wonk. He sent me an email and said, I am torn. My heart is with Warren and Bernie. My head is with Klobuchar and Pete. I don't know what to do. I don't even know what electability means. I can't understand how to take on Donald Trump. Listen to what he's saying. Listen to what he's saying, everyone. This isn't moderate wing, progressive wing. This is really kind of looking at Donald Trump, the liar in chief, the person who will do the most dastardly things to win this election, and trying to figure out, in something we have never experienced before, what can take him on? That is not a left-right conversation. This is about looking at a tyrant and saying, how do you undermine and challenge a tyrant? That is what, again, is so frightening here. I don't know.
Yeah, I think the sense of stakes, too, it's this, I think there's a narrative, this Democrats in disarray narrative, which, you know, after Iowa does make some sense, but also, you know, there's this obsession with turnout, which, right, you know, the narrative in New Hampshire was, oh no, looks like another bad night of turnout. Well, it ended up being
the highest ever. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And, you know, I think what's happening, one, it's difficult to tell where it's coming from. I mean, I think when you go out and talk to voters, like, people are nervous,
right,
which they should be. They want to beat Donald Trump, that is the number one priority of mm-hmm. voters, particularly people of color. But the problem is that we don't really know how to do that, right? I mean, I think if you look at the polls, you say, well, most of these candidates, with sort of exception of Pete, consistently poll much better than the president does. Electability is, I think, still largely a myth. It's, or at the very least, it's an art and not a science.
And the other thing is that I, you know, as I mentioned, that the mainstream media gave, you know, $2 billion to Donald Trump in free media in order to sort of sustain him and create him as a monster. They've done almost the opposite with Bernie Sanders, where they've either trashed him and called him a communist, just like Donald Trump, how convenient of them, or they ignored him completely. The other thing that's also so interesting is, think of all the media narratives that have propped up Joe Biden. I mean, Joe Biden, if he were anybody else, Joe Biden would have dropped out 7 months ago. I mean, let's be honest here. But even when he doesn't appear on the Sunday shows, even when he didn't appear, they kept propping him up. Someone said it was like watching The Sixth Sense, you know? I hear dead people. And yet it was the media that heard Joe. Nobody else heard Joe. He didn't show up. He didn't have big crowds. He didn't talk. And isn't it ironic? They were holding him up, even though there was nothing to hold, and they were basically ignoring Bernie Sanders. So the media needs to understand they are owning these results. And if these results are confusing, they better start blaming themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you, I guess I'm sort of, not to defend the sometimes indefensible, uh-huh. I think, you know, Biden's polling lead was consistent, right? And uh-huh. I think that there was this sense of inevitability that was driving his campaign. It certainly was driving him to not work particularly hard or go on TV or, you know, have these big events. But the other issue is always enthusiasm. And people were seeing this on the ground. People were seeing this when you're looking at the polls. And then once you started to dig into the numbers, particularly fundraising and enthusiasm, you know, I was writing a year ago that Sanders was the front runner by almost any reasonable metric, and that Biden, in fact, was a pretty weak candidate because his only argument was that was his electability. And if that were to fade, which anyone looking at the polls in Iowa and New Hampshire were to say that this guy's going to probably start losing elections right away,
right?
Then this was entirely predictable. And yet, there was a failure to reckon with that.
Well, and again, the value of small states like, I hate to say this, Iowa and New Hampshire, is that we actually got to see him. And we're like, what are we seeing? Listen to his language. Look at how he talks. I said the other day that I was watching him at the Hunter Club dinner, and he gave this speech, and I said I needed a GPS to follow where the hell he was going. I mean, what does that say? And only in places that are small, where you're not propping up a narrative, you're actually seeing the human being and realizing the human being doesn't even come close, isn't a shadow of the narrative that they're putting forward. And that's where you got a message out of Iowa and New Hampshire. He's yesterday's story. He has no capacity to lead this nation. He's a nice man, but he really is an old man. Sometimes I feel Mayor Pete is an old man too. You know, it's not age. It's a function of narrative and their ability to sort of engage. And why you see Mayor Pete so engaging with 69-year-olds and 72-year-olds, you know, that was Joe Biden's territory, but Mayor Pete connects with them. And yet the old man, Bernie Sanders, is connecting with 25-year-olds. Go figure. Don't look at a number. Look at how they relate. And that should tell you more than anything else, who is relating to the future and who is relating to the past. All right, Alex, I only have like 5 minutes left. And what I realize is it is February. It is Black History Month. You wrote a piece that I really want to just touch on before I let you go, How to Mess Up Black History Month. Can you just quickly share with my audience what happened? I don't want to lose this because we're so distracted.
Yeah, it's always a small story, but one I think says a lot about New York publishing. I, you know, cover politics and media, but do some publishing reporting as well. And there was this initiative between Penguin Random House, which is the largest publisher in the world, and Barnes & Noble, the largest bookstore in America, and a sort of media and PR company, to celebrate Black History Month by giving new book covers to classic works like Moby Dick and Alice in Wonderland, but with sort of diverse characters representing these books. Now, the obvious problem here is that the publishing industry is not representative at all, and there have been, you know, some very courageous people who have, I think, worked very hard over the last 5 years to draw attention to this fact, but, you know, the majority of the books that are published are written by white people. So, you know, it's this very tokenizing and, you know, pretty offensive way of trying to say, oh, well, you know, if we can just imagine black characters into these works, but, and, you know, we'll do that instead of spending money to actually publish.
Let me use a word that was used. The initiative was described as literary blackface. Oh, my God. That's just shocking. And, you know, but let me just say something. But here is the problem. You look at the performances of some of Shakespeare's plays. You look at some of the ballets. You look at some of the things. We have tried to diversify. You know, I mean, that is really important. Look at people who have, you know, made a black Santa Claus, you know. I mean, it's we've been doing this for a long time because in a lot of ways, because whites have owned the story and because whites have written the history and because whites, you know, have controlled the money and the outcomes, everything is done through a white lens. If Santa Claus is made up, maybe Santa Claus is every color. Maybe he's Asian. Maybe he's black. Maybe he's a Jew. Who knows? You know what I mean? And so part of the reason I kind of feel bad for them, because the idea of literary blackface is problematic. But I think the real storyline here is, why don't you celebrate African-American writers? They have stories to tell, too. They have children in their stories, too. They have fairy tales, too. Tell those stories. Don't try to bastardize what was, you know, what is in existence. Try to elevate what you've ignored for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, there are these other initiatives, too, which I think are quite interesting. There's one that, you know, they're paying writers to reimagine Shakespeare's works. I think, you know, Jeanine Winterson has done one. And there's another version of this project where you could imagine a publisher investing money and saying, we want to reimagine these works and hire writers from diverse backgrounds to provide some sort of spin on them.
Yes.
And that is a way of actually engaging with this material. Right. Again, much of which was written in times of colonialism and imperialism, not to mention slavery and other horrors.
Yes.
But the issue is that that would cost money. It would take time. And what publishers want to do is show that they care about these issues, but they are not interested in putting the work in.
And I think the word that is so important is, you can reimagine Alice. You can rewrite the story for today. You can have some, I mean, that's fine. But I think the idea of, again, I'm going to use that word, which was just so powerful and so painful, literary blackface, that is, it's cheap. It's convenient. It looks like somehow you're acknowledging diversity, and you're doing everything but that. And that is what is so frightening. Alex Shepard writes for The New Republic. We so value your voice. We value your writing. He is a staff writer. And the two pieces that we spent most of the time on is How to Do Math Like a Pundit, his most recent piece at The New Republic. And, of course, is Bernie Sanders Has an MSNBC Problem. I promise I'll stop throwing things at my TV set. And it is Black History Month. We'll spend more time than just this with folks like Alex Shepard. But thank you so much for writing this. We'll be talking to you soon.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude. We'll see you next week. You better-